Hello and welcome to Tippy Talk. Today we are going to bring another episode about books into Tippy Talk with the angel from Newborn, who is our official music producer for the show.
Will you find me?
Of Newborn's music, you go to newborn.com to hear that beautiful sound. And welcome to Books I Love Today on Tippy Talk, which is for published authors as well as unpublished authors and wannabe authors. We also speak to people who love to read and all other things related to the reading world. So if you have a story to tell and want to write it down in a book or an essay, or especially if it comes to the right place, because here you can also speak about it. If you read a book and you want to either discuss it or speak with the author, you're also in the right place. This is where the written word will survive and thrive, where the authors get a chance to speak and the readers get to enjoy the written word. And this has been moved over from Books I Love into Tippy Talk, which is very, very comfortable for you, because now you can listen to all the things that we talk about on one location. Welcome to Tippy Talk. My name is Tippy Felsenstein, and today we have Meryl Sussman returning to us as our guest to talk about her little short story book called Into a Good Day. But before we start talking to Meryl, we have the quote of the day today, which is specifically geared towards people who want to write a book but haven't started. And the quote says, that vocation which we wanted to pursue but didn't bleed like colors on the whole of our existence. And Honoré de Balzac said that, and he was right. Do not let one more day go by without honoring the vocation your soul calls you to pursue. And don't pretend you don't know what it is, because of course you do. You can feel it in your stomach whenever you think about it, whenever you see another person doing it. So life is short. Do now what you yearn to do in your life. You do not have to quit your day job in order to do this. You may do so if you choose to, but you do not have to. Many people advance a vocation while holding down the regular job. You can too. So ease into your vocation and turn it into your regular job. But you must give energy to your vocation starting today. And I mean today, because that's exactly what I had to do. I had to really start writing. Otherwise, that would have never happened. So our guest today did exactly that. She started writing, and she produced some amazing books together with her brother. And the specific story that we're going to talk about today, which is Into a Good Day, is a story that happened at the end of the 19th century. And in her work, Charles Dickens, most notable in Oliver Twist, he wrote about the harsh realities of the lives of poor children and women, and how much more difficult was life for women and children at the beginning of that century. Into a Good Day is set in 1805 in Eastern Europe, and it offers different images of children, those that eagerly desire, those hidden from view, children cherished, despite their special needs, children abandoned because they're different, children scarred by the horrors they have seen, but saved by those who are willing to care. And he tells of their mothers, those who are cherished and honored, those who do their best under the worst circumstances, those who have no choices at all. Into a Good Day tells the story of a community determined to protect its children from the violence threatened at an age-old horrific libel surfaces once again to stir up religious hatred. And that's, in a nutshell, what Into a Good Day really represents. Hi, Meryl Sussman. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Tippi, to come back. I enjoy listening to you, and your message at the beginning is inspirational, so thank you.
Thank you so much, Meryl. I don't just like what you wrote for the story itself, which the story is great because one of the things that you do that not many authors do is you make the reader feel like they're right there in the middle of it. In the beginning of Into a Good Day, you describe an event, a holiday, specifically Purim, a kind of like a family festival. And the way you introduce every character, and the way you describe even that little five-year-old kid that can't speak, you automatically fall in love with him, and you automatically feel like you really know him from the inside out. So that takes a lot of talent. It takes a lot of time, and I know it takes a lot of effort to do because there aren't many authors that succeed in doing that. Was that something that you find natural that you do, or was it something you really had to think about?
You know, it's interesting that you focus on that character, the little boy, Sally. I wrote a first draft of the story, and I sent it to some trusted readers, you know, who would give me feedback. And they said, we don't care yet about Sally because he's on the fringes of the story. And I realized exactly what you said. I hadn't gotten close enough to him to really make him vital. And so that feedback was very helpful. So I reworked it with and very clearly it became a story of children. Initially, it was a story of the adults who were deciding that they would not take this type of terrorism anymore. They wouldn't be attacked again. But instead, it became a story of children and how children experience the world around them, sometimes not seeing the danger, and sometimes, in the case of Sally, seeing the danger, experiencing the danger and the horror, and not knowing how to recover from it because it's so overwhelming that it rendered him speechless and rendered him unable to be touched because of the fear that enveloped him. And so it's really about the children, and I wanted to talk about how important a community can be, you know, the old expression of it takes a village, how important a community is to band together and to protect their children. I did use the holiday of Purim because for those who don't know the holiday, it's often been described as a Jewish Mardi Gras. It's a festival of focused on children. There's costumes, there's parades, there's games and silly contests. But the story of Purim is quite horrific if you look at the story as it's told in the Megillah. It's a story of a community that was facing genocide and how some people stood up and went to the center of power. In that case, it was the Shah of Persia, to plead their case to avoid the day of horror when the Jewish population of Persia was going to be decimated. And so it's interesting to me that this horrible event has changed into a festival where the children are dressed as the characters in the story and are spared the horror by the games and festivals and the clownish behavior, the topsy-turvy day. And yet that horror is always lurking behind the scenes because that's the story that's told in the religious part of the holiday.
Yeah, and you're right. It is a children's story the way you wrote it, and thank you for clarifying what Purim is. Like, not everybody knows what it is.
Mm-hmm.
But the way you present it is as a festival, and yeah, kind of like a Mardi Gras. And in a way, it is a children's story because a lot of it is written through the perspective perspective of a child, but then it's really not a children's story at all. It's a very serious, very adult story that shows another side of people who are victims, not just going along with the program and being victims. And so there's so many different facets here. I just picked that child because you're right, he did stand out. But there's other elements to the book that are really beautiful, especially to people who like to read and they like to write. And I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. So in the beginning of the story, for those of you who haven't read it, the description is of a day, of an event, of a family getting together and celebrating this holiday. And there's no clue at all that something is about to happen that's going to change and change everything, but yet you also say they have to continue pretending nothing else has happened. But the way you wrote it, and sometimes the words you use, so without giving away the end of the story, there is a place where they go to a cemetery and they talk to someone. And the way you described it is he laughs, the sound echoing against the cold walls. And that one sentence describes the whole atmosphere. It's not just a cemetery, they're standing in a cemetery, you're not really saying anything about it, but just saying that his sound of his words echoing off, you can see the graveyards, you can hear his voice, you can feel the dense atmosphere of their gathering, which is a happy occasion. And so sometimes a few words used in a way like that says so much more than anything else. You can describe that in one whole page, but yet you were able to, in one sentence, tell us exactly how everybody felt to that place.
Actually, it's interesting because as I think most writers, I'm a great reader, and I am amazed sometimes at, and many times, beautiful description where people will talk about the setting and talk about the clothing and talk about what's on the table. And I tend not to do that because I find that I want to really portray it the way the characters experience it. When you do a very intricate description, it's almost as if you're looking at a painting. But if you're a character and you're in the place and you're talking to someone who you suspect, and I don't want to give everything away, but you suspect has an other motive, and his laughter rings off the cold stones, I think that's all you really need to know. You don't have to describe all the details of the scene, because the person who's listening to that man, that's what it strikes him, is that, you know, the echoing sound of this laughter is so sinister. And so that's the way I focus on description. So you'll find very little about costume and about how people are doing their hair and, you know, when I talk about what they're eating, it's usually something that has a point. They're eating certain foods because it's traditional, or they're eating certain foods because the farmer who, where a lot of this takes place on his farm, is known for his cheese. And so there's a point for it.
There's a point for everything. Yeah. But it also shows a lot of thoughts that you don't just throw words out for the sake of throwing words out. You think about what you're going to say. So reading this book, which is only 10 chapters, is it 10 or 11 chapters? It's a very short story, but in those words, which you condensed so well, I would say that if somebody who didn't think so much about words, this story would be twice as long, just to describe all those things that you're able to condense into an atmosphere by saying one sentence. That's very, very unique and very talented way of describing things.
Well, thank you. It's actually very hard. I mean, some of the books in the series, and the series is published under my brother's name, so it's under Ezekiel Nieto Ben Zion. But in the series, part of we wrote a book that's 500 pages, and but how hard it was very hard to write a book that was only 110 pages, because you're right. You have room to go off on a description or to add some details. But when you deliberately want to limit yourself to not more than 120 pages, now you're talking. You really have to weigh everything you introduce. There was a lot left on the cutting room floor because we realized that. It was something we enjoyed. It was a great scene that we loved, but, you know, it wasn't pertinent to the pace of the story, and we just had to, you know, thank God with word processes you can sort of cut it and put it in another file and say someday I'll get back to it. But
makes it easier,
Right. It makes it easier than if you were literally erasing it. But we really wanted to hone in on the tension. And I should say, while the story talks about all different types of children, the tension is that the adults see the world obviously more clearly. So they see beyond the celebration of this fun festival to the danger that lurks out there. And so there's as if their antenna have to be focused on anything out in the greater world that signals oncoming violence, while their attention also has to be focused on providing for their children, in a way, an artificial Eden. And one of the main characters always describes his farm as the Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden, but recognizes that the serpent was able to invade the Garden of Eden. So he's always on the lookout for that danger. So the adults are very tense and looking out. The children don't see that, except this one character, as we talked about, Sally, because he's seen it personally. He has been a victim of violence. His family was a victim of violence, and therefore he is the one child who wanders through this joyous festival, not being able to participate. It's not until the end where he finally feels that he's safer than he was. The other thing I wanted to mention, because this story was part of a tale that my grandmother told us. Most of the stories in the series are based on what my grandfather told us as he was in his mid-90s, and I think felt that if he didn't tell us the stories, they would be totally lost. But my grandmother
told
us. Which
he was right. It would be.
He was right, right. And it was a treasure that we really wanted to make sure people heard about. And one of the things my grandmother added was how every spring, because of the danger of this this vicious libel, it's called the blood libel for those who don't know it, but periodically people would be inflamed that the Jews were sacrificing Christian children to make their Passover matzah, Passover is a spring holiday. So in the spring, her family would pack up and go to the other village that she described as the safe village, because they knew danger lurked in their village, that they could be attacked. And what was the safe village? It was a village like the one depicted where the men fought back. And so it was spared. They weren't easy victims. And that resonated, the idea that people were on the watch for these dangers and they banded together to fight them off. And I just imagine, because she was very young at the time. I mean, she came to America when she was 8, so this was occurring probably when she was about Sally's age. And
right.
So her awareness of danger and the idea that it was around them and they had to go to a safe place, and the thing that made that place safe was that people were not going to be victims. They were going to fight back. And that's where
right.
she actually...
Yeah, right. We're talking to Meryl Sussman, who co-authored a book called, a lot of books actually, but the one that we're talking about today is Into a Good Day with her brother, Ezekiel Ben-Tzion. And the book that we're specifically talking about, Into a Good Day, is a very short story, really charming, that I recommend that everybody read, and it's a quick read. But yet, you might want to savor it and not read it in one day. If you do want to read this book or find out more about other books, you can go to the website. And can you tell us the website?
The website is Telling Our Tales. Telling Our Tales, plural. It is one word. Telling Our Tales at
dot.
I'm blanking. dot. I'm
selling
so
our
sorry.
Tales. Dot.
Dot net.
Dot com. Dot net.
Dot net. Yeah. Selling our tales. Dot net. Dot net. And at that site, we try to encourage people to tell us their tales, too. Again, with the feeling that the generation that is passing on had rich stories, particularly if they were immigrants, because they have a foot in both worlds. You know, they left the old country, whatever it was, most of the time under difficult circumstances. And they arrived in America or England or other Australia. We've had some people talk to us about their stories for safe haven, whether it was economic survival, whether it was religious, fleeing religious persecution. And those stories are disappearing as they age out, and what we want to do is capture them.
Yeah, and the story that we're specifically speaking about right now is Into a Good Day. And as you were describing the fact that the entire village was afraid of those libels or those basically vicious lies that people were spreading about the mm-hmm. Passover, they literally had to pick up everything they owned and go to another village, kind of like the New Yorkers pick up everything and go to the country every summer. It's a lot of work.
Right, right.
They may not do it for safety, but it is a lot of work to pack up and go and then pack up and come back. And doing it for fear of your life is not mm-hmm. is not something that people are aware of, but it's a fact. And as you were talking and as you were describing the fact that they were going to shelter and the fact that she was only 8 years old, it kind of brought up memories within me because I was 8 years old and I was born in Jerusalem and when the Six-Day War broke out. And the whole journey of my family having to first have suitcases packed and ready to go to shelter when if and when we got attacked. And that mm-hmm. was very scary. And then, actually, when we got attacked and the sirens went off, having to walk to the shelter while the sirens, and as an eight-year-old, I remember the atmosphere. I remember people running around in circles, really not knowing where they were going. And I remember us walking, and me with my mother with a whole bunch of my younger sisters and brothers, walking towards the shelter by ourselves because my father had passed away. And even though I was only eight, that day is very vivid in my mind. It's mm-hmm. not a day mm-hmm. that I will forget. And while you were describing your grandmother's memory of walking to shelter, and because I think you used the word shelter, mm-hmm. it brought up those memories of that day, which just goes to show you that some things never change. Mm-hmm. You still have the same community. You still have them going to shelter because somebody wants to hurt them, again, based on stories that are really not true, have no basis in reality, but only exist in order to hurt that community.
Right.
So that's why this story, Into a Good Day, it's a great read, and it's a great story, but it has history in it. It has a part of a reality of people that are constantly living under the threat of violence because of lies. Same thing, same story.
Mm-hmm.
And because those lies actually, with the time, got bigger and bolder and uglier and have no basis even in reality of any sense, and yet mm-hmm. people believe it, and yet people react to it. And they
well, the thing
that... Yes.
I'm sorry, I didn't
go
mean
ahead.
To interrupt.
That's okay.
The thing that fascinated us about so many of these stories is that when you start thinking about them, as you absolutely just said, They're not stories that don't exist today. So people were grappling with the idea of fear of being subjected to violence. But even as I tell the stories, we have children who have a handicap or children who were born and abandoned and children, and we see that today. And we have more resources. We can work with children who have different illnesses in ways that were not available in the early 1800s. So I like the fact that these characters have parallels, that it's not a story like in a time capsule where you look back and say, isn't that quaint? It's so different. And I should point out that there are records of this same libel resurfacing in England in the 1920s and in America in the 1920s. And I think you're right. It takes different forms to blame a community, whether it's blaming Muslims for all the terrorism in the world or blaming Jews for the fact that there are Muslim terrorists. You know, there are all these accusations that have no foundation in fact result in violence against communities. I think that there's a desire still for parents to say, I don't want my children to know all the bad things in the world. I want to protect them from this. And inevitably, children do find out, as you experienced it at 8, and as my grandmother experienced it, and as the children in the story, they're sensitive beings, and they know that the adults are concerned about something. And while they might not know exactly what it is, the fear, except for that one child who actually experienced it, the tension, the fear is going to be part of their lives. And what I'm hoping also is that we do have stories of people who stood up and fought back and how hard it was. But in particular in this story, the ability to fight back takes a different approach where they were able to get people of good, of kind people and interested people to work with them to avert the tragedies, which is
correct.
A different
so,
way.
So I'm going to so I'm going to give away a little bit more of the story.
Okay.
Just to tease everybody, but I'm not going to give away the end. And so what happens in the middle of the festival is they find out somebody comes to them. The groundkeeper comes to them, to the head of the families, and lets them know that a baby was found. And that very, very likely that the baby was found dead, and that was going to be blamed on the Jews for killing the baby and using the blood to bake their matzahs or whatever else that they were using the blood for. And therefore, maybe if you give me some money, I may be able to help you. And so they have to do something about it, and they try to avert the tragedy that is almost inevitable from happening. And that's when you have to read the rest of the book to find out how they do that and what happens. What happens at the end of the day and, you know, who the baby is, why the baby is there, and all those little details that you may or may not find out when you read it. And so this is a very happy event, definitely marred with potential very tragic ending. So that's the essence of it. And the thing that's what I'm saying about this book, it's a story. It's something that is happening today. It is very well written, and it's very important to pass that down. And basically what it is it's a story that based on reality, based on things that did happen, except that the characters are not fictional in a way.
Yes.
They're maybe fictional with based on real characters, but definitely made more colorful.
Yeah. We actually have one of the things that I do is some of the characters, actually one of my children said to me, Mom, am I in those books? Because some of the personalities, some of the personalities are, to make them vivid, I use people I knew. And my grandmother lives on in many of these characters because she was a very, and I will share that she appears in this book as Rebbitzin Sylvie, a midwife.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. I get it.
Right. She was not a brothel keeper, and she wasn't a midwife. But she was that type of person who
character.
Would say, right. And she would say, as she would say, I'm telling you what's what. And often with a finger in your chest, I'm telling you what's what. And she was one of those people who really survived. I observed her in America, of course. But my mother used to say, her daughter, well, she tells the stories to really reflect her experience, even though we know that not all of them are true. So when she talks about the fact that she told us the story that her mother was literate, could read, which was not all that common. Now, this is my great-grandmother in Europe, and would, and she says she was a hunchback. Well, she probably had scoliosis, but she would, you know, sort of like shuffle when she walked, but she was carrying political pamphlets between, under her skirts as she went from visiting family from family, and she would hand them out. So here's this woman, my grandmother telling this story, who was poor, living in a tiny village that was often victimized, and yet would do her best to spread the word about organizing against the political powers. So I'm thinking, wow, these characters were brave, and I want them to live on. And since I don't even, I've never spoken to my great-grandmother. She died when my grandmother was quite young. I want to celebrate them by putting them into the characters. So the idea of building these fictional characters is a way to tell our tales and to remember those people who survived. And
survived and fought and did everything in their power to make life better for the future generations.
That's right.
And so, and you did that very successfully. You did that in a beautiful, successful way in this little tale. Of course, I'm looking forward to reading 500 pages and all the other ones, but this is a very short, very condensed story of a very important part. And the parallel that we have of people right now spreading a lot of stories is the BDS movement telling horrific tales of things that never happened and never existed. And yes, they are Muslim, and the Muslim community, not every single Muslim on this planet is a terrorist or specifically does that, but a huge percentage of the Muslim community is attacking and is killing and is really responsible for a lot of terrorism. So you have to be careful, but you also have to, like your grandmother said, I'm telling you what it is. And like my sister just told me this week, I'm just telling you the truth. Do you want me not to tell you the truth? Fine, I won't tell you the truth.
Right.
But that's the way of life is right now, today, as we live. And we do have to do exactly what your great-grandmother did. We have to do whatever little part or big part that we can play, and telling those stories is a huge part, as is my writing, and whatever you can contribute, don't sit back and not do anything thinking that your little contribution is not going to help, because it is a big part of it, a tiny little bit. One drop makes an ocean, one drop from each person. And So your work has a lot more dimensions than just telling a story, letting people know, telling your personal story, not wanting it to die, but also letting people know that your part is important, because you don't know how many lives you're going to save by telling your story, basically.
And we have that saying in our tradition is that it's when you save one life, it's as if you saved the world.
Exactly. As it is. It's exactly what it is.
So we honor anything that you have to do to save a life. And when one of the things that I also wanted to say in the book is the idea of the lives of the women. We have women who are pregnant or gave birth, and they are highly respected, and they're honored by their families. And then we have stories of women who are desperate straits because childbirth is a high risk to their survival, both physically and in their family's economic straits, how fragile their family is, another mouth to feed. And in the case of some of the children, a child who is born and is not perfect, and will need extra care or never contribute to the family income. What do I do? Where do I go with this child? And so I did want to feature, there are some chapters, as you know, that have midwives talking about the condition of women, because we very easily forget how perilous it was for women who were poor and pregnant and needed to feed their families and now were facing the risk of dying in childbirth, which was very common, and or struggling to make ends meet with a ever-growing family. So I wanted to tell their stories too, because you really can't tell the story of children without telling the stories of the mothers and the families that are, you know, connected to them. And that's what I use the Rebbitz and Sylvie for, is the ability to share in discussions with other midwives the difficulties they have seen and what they understand of women's lives in the early 19th century. And we are very blithe about talking about whether you're pro-choice or pro-life or whatever, but this was, people were struggling with the idea that they had little control over their size of their families, and they had little resources if they had a child that needed extra help. And I did want to tell that part of the story as well.
Yes, and that's a very important part of the story. And speaking about a child that is born different and needs more care than most, I just want to mention that we have an upcoming soon that you will hear an event about a woman that was told in her 8th month of pregnancy that on Rosh Hashanah that her child is retarded and needs to be taken out right away. So stay tuned for that. This is coming up in the next few weeks. And back to Into a Good Day, this is a story about children, about adults, about an event, and it takes place approximately 200 years ago, right?
Well, yeah, 200 years ago, you're right. Oh, my gosh.
Time flies when you're having fun.
Yeah.
It's a long time ago, so.
Right. Yes.
Takes place in Europe, right?
In Bohemia.
Bohemia. It's a Bohemian story.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And it is, what were you going to say?
No, I was going to say that the thing that struck me when I was thinking about this story is I remember being, as a kid, when I read Oliver Twist, being devastated by the description of the workhouses and the pregnant women who were in prison and the children who were being sold off to work under difficult circumstances. And then I said, well, wait a minute, what happened almost 100 years earlier? And the truth is that childhood as we know it did not exist until probably the middle of, probably after World War I, because children were considered part of the workforce. There were no child labor laws. Children on farms worked as soon as they were able to. Children, as my grandfather told us, at 9, he was sent off to work in a factory. And it was a question of if you could earn money for the family, you were going to earn money for the family. And so the idea of childhood, of being indulged, of having only playtime and everyone sort of focused on your well-being did not really exist in the way that we think of it. I mean, there was, for many children, there was no formal schooling. And there was surely no laws that said you could not put a child to work, or they were limited in what they could do or the hours they could work. And so that's part of the story. So you have, in Oliver Twist, you have workhouses and unscrupulous officials that sold the labor of children. If you wanted a healthy boy to work in your factory, you paid the head of the workhouse to get him. And you have, even in charitable organizations, you have the pressure of orphans being sent off to families, not because they desperately wanted a child, but because they wanted another pair of hands to work on the farm or in the shop or to do any tasks. And I also wanted to bring that up, that child protection was something that no one thought of well into the 20th century.
So, well into the 20th century, because I remember even my mother was taken out of school at age 10 to help support the family, and she mm-hmm. went to a factory and started working. And that's just my mother, not even my grandmother
right.
generation.
Right.
At that time,
right.
there was also no law, not in Jerusalem, not under the British mandate, definitely, which was where she lived. There was no mm-hmm. laws like that. That's really fairly very new. I think it just happened in our generation, don't you think, and about or the baby boomer generation.
Well, actually, it probably came through in the progressive era in the United States, where people were, where they had settlement houses and workmen's circles and things of that type, where they were focused on improving the lives of families. I remember, and that was also, I mean, my grandfather was very active in those types of workmen's circles, where people would come down and laborers would come at night to learn to read in English or to study to be a citizen. And in that, in the labor organizing movement, it was against child labor as well, because number one is they wanted the jobs to go to the adults, but number two, they had seen how easily children are victimized. So in his labor organizing, the labor unions that rose in the 1920s focused on child labor laws. But whether they were all passed or they on a federal level or whether it was particular states that took action, yeah, it was the 1920s and 30s before people started talking about protecting children. And compulsory education, you know, keeping kids mm-hmm. in school until they were 16, was something mm-hmm. that came rather late as well. So kids could be pulled, as your mother experienced, taken out of school when they were barely literate to get a job. My grandmother was so proud that all her children finished high school.
That's
I mean,
right.
That's
a big thing.
Yeah,
very
it was a big
thing
that they finished high school. And back in the day, high schools trained you for work. My mother was trained as a bookkeeper. My father was able to go on because of the GI Bill, so he was able to go on and become a lawyer. But that was an accomplishment that all her children graduated from high school. And we look at that as such a minimum nowadays. But so we have a community back in the early 1800s that had no school. What the children learned was what the parents banded together, and maybe they hired a scholar to come and teach their kids in very informal ways, or they were able to teach them themselves. As the books progress, the community gets more and more organized, and so they start, because they're growing, so as
right.
families come into this community because it's safe, there's the stories about they hire a young rabbi to teach the kids, or they decide that you're good in math, so you'll teach the kids math, and I know Czech or German, I'll teach the kids that language. So it was all community-based as well.
Right, right. And hopefully our society will keep evolving into a better and more productive, more profound life, actually, where we actually live for a purpose and we know what we want and we produce. That's the mm-hmm. hope, that we're not going to devolve and go backwards, that
right.
rather that we will improve. And I think that's what the mission is for me, to make the world a better place, one person at a time, one life at a time, one project at a time. And the specific interest, my specific passion, is about telling your story, not being afraid that you will, some people will love you, some people will hate you for it, but that's irrelevant. As long as you tell the story that you want to tell, tell your story. And that makes a difference. You don't know how many lives you're going to touch. You don't know how many people are going to read this and make a decision like, yes, I can stand up for myself too.
Mm-hmm.
It just,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's basically what this book is all about.
Well, we talked a lot about 110 pages, so I really am pleased.
Well, you know, we could have read 110 pages
mm-hmm.
in 1 hour. Not exactly,
mm-hmm.
but we could have tried. But
mm-hmm.
like I said, this book is not just about reading a story of 110 pages, mm-hmm. and because it encompasses so much more than that, in one tiny little book. And it just shows you, you don't always have to write 500 pages to convey a huge message. Sometimes it is necessary to give all the details, and that's why we have all those different information that we want. And I can read 5 million pages and 5 trillion pages and still not have enough, because there's always more.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't have to read an entire library to begin. You can start reading with this. If you're not a reader, this is a great book to start, because it will keep your attention, it will teach you a few things, and it will motivate you to read the next book. Definitely do that.
Oh, thank you.
And so I want to really thank you for joining us today and giving us insight into the thought process behind this.
Oh, I appreciate the opportunity. I also just wanted to say that one of the thoughts that we communicated in the book, or we hope to, was the idea that support of women and children who are vulnerable means says a lot about a society. And I think we need to focus on providing opportunities for women and children to be safe and cared for and to thrive.
All women and all children of all nations and all religions,
mm-hmm.
and all continents. There's no discriminating between one
right.
woman or another, between one nation and another.
And research has shown that if the women are educated and have economic security, peace descends on the community. Because women women do not eagerly sacrifice their children if they're feeling that there are alternatives for strong and healthy lives. They tend to keep them close, there have been people who say that by promoting education for women, promoting health and well-being for children, you will see a decrease of violence in communities. So that's the other thing I'm hoping that people see the importance of protecting the women and helping them thrive, whoever they are, wherever they are, that it means a lot for our universal security.
Yes, education mm-hmm. for women and for children and for adults mm-hmm. who haven't had a chance to get their
mm-hmm.
education. I think that really is the basis, and that's the beginning of everything. And that's why writing books is so important, because that's basically education that never
mm-hmm.
stops. It doesn't even have to be a formal education. It could be any kind of education. You can educate yourself. My mother educated herself because she was so passionate about it. So if my mother could do it, anybody could do it. If she was taken out of school at 10 and could educate herself to learn to read and write 3 languages, anybody can do it.
Mm-hmm. And there are stories of that type. My grandfather, who, as I mentioned, as the character who represents him, I don't think he went beyond the age of 10 or 12 in any formal education. He came to America when he was 14. And as far as I know, it was Workman's Circle, which was a free education and social and political agency that educated him. But my father always pointed to the fact that in his Yiddish library, my grandfather had the works of great literature translated into Yiddish, of all things, and great philosophers.
Mm-hmm.
And his the standard music I remember him listening to was all classical. So this is all things that he continued to educate himself in without formal schooling, because he had a passion for that. And as you said, he worked long days, but when he came home, this was really before the days everyone had TVs in every room. It was all about reading and listening to good music and the radio and keeping up on current events. So he was reading newspapers in Yiddish. But it was a passion for education, I think, that he inspired his children with. And he did it all on his own.
Exactly. So go out and educate yourself. Go
mm-hmm.
go into this website and find the book Into a Good Day, and the website is tellingourtale.net.
Mm-hmm.
Telling Our Tales with an S, right?
Right.
.net. And we will put the link right here at the bottom, and you can come join us back here on Tiffy Talk. We are talking to Meryl Sussman. My name is Tiffy Feldenstein, and you are listening to Tippy Talk on Books I Love. I want to once again thank you so much for joining us, and we're looking forward to speaking with you again soon.
Definitely
working on that. We will be returning to talk about names and the origin and what they mean and where they come from and maybe where they're going to in a few weeks. So thank you again, and we will be talking to you really, really soon.
Thank you. Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Don't need a man, you got a phone in your hand, and you can keep it silent, flying high like the birds with your aviators, but your heart is on autopilot, yeah.
You've been listening to Books I Love with me, Tippy Feldenstein. We bid you a magical journey and let your talent be your potion. My name is Tippy Feldenstein, and I personally wish you magic.
Are you thinking about buying medicine online? A search for online pharmacies yields more than 20 million results. But which ones can you trust? Medicines bought from unlicensed online pharmacies can be dangerous. You may get a fake drug, your condition may get worse, or you may experience a bad reaction. Don't put your health at risk. To learn how to find an online pharmacy that's safe and legal, visit fda.gov/besaferx. A message from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration.